Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
The FT.
Welcome back to Banking Weekly with me, Patrick Jenkins. Today, I'm joined in the studio by Brooke Masters, our Chief Regulation Correspondent, Charlene Goff, our Retail Banking Correspondent, and down the line from Beijing, Simon Rabinovich, our Financials Correspondent in China. First today, we'll look at China Construction Bank and suggestions that the second biggest bank in China may be looking for an acquisition in Europe. Secondly, we'll turn our attention to HBOS and the action by regulators against the former corporate lending boss there. And thirdly, we'll look at the trial of Kweku Adeboli, the UBS trader. First, though, to China Construction Bank, CCB. This is China's second biggest bank by assets, and they have been interviewed by us and told us quite an interesting tale about their ambitions for making acquisitions, particularly in Europe, focused on maybe UK, France and Germany. I spoke earlier to Simon Rabinovich, our Beijing correspondent, about that story. So, Simon, thanks very much for joining us. This is quite big news, isn't it, really, that China Construction Bank is signalling an interest in a potential foreign acquisition? It's not as if China's banks have done many of these types of deals. How seriously do you take it?
Certainly for them to come out and say, first of all, that they're interested in making foreign acquisitions, and then second of all, to specify that they are interested in looking at European financial institutions, and then third of all, to talk, hypothetically at least, about quite a big number. Putting all that together, it is quite big news. Before the financial crisis in 2007, we saw a variety of Chinese banks and financial institutions coming out and making investments abroad. But since the crisis, they've really turned incredibly cautious, incredibly wary. And people have been waiting to see if they would develop more of an appetite for foreign acquisitions. And it seems with the CCB statement that in fact they might now be developing that.
Well, as you say, one of the interesting points was the kind of geographical focus, and the chairman talked to us about, at some length really, about the Eurozone crisis and the opportunities that he thought were being thrown up by that. Not, I'm sure cautious bankers would be glad to hear, in the peripheral part of the Eurozone, so Spain or Italy, he's clearly still fairly cautious about, but particularly talking about the UK, obviously, as a non-Eurozone country, but also France and Germany as being attractive markets. And that one senses particularly Germany might be an interesting focus. We've had deeper kind of political affiliations developing seemingly between Germany and China, a recent delegation by Chancellor Merkel going to Beijing. And I just wonder, I mean, the kind of tittle-tattle among investment bankers is certainly that Commerzbank, which is Germany's second biggest listed lender, could be a very interesting target. Certainly by size, in terms of their market value these days, they're tiny, less than 10 billion euros for the whole bank, and probably the government stake is about 25%, so it might be a quite interesting way for them to move forward.
Well, I mean, looking at it more broadly, Europe is an interesting area for Chinese banks to be focusing on for two reasons. One is that although Chinese banks have been cautious, they have moved abroad in certain parts of the world. And so they do have a skeletal presence in South America and North America and Africa and Asia. Europe, they've only really had organic expansion so far. They've not made any big acquisitions. So that is a big gap in the Chinese bank's portfolio. But the other thing is that the reason that Chinese banks have been looking to expand abroad is that they've really been trying to follow their companies, and industrial companies in particular, as they've been expanding. And so Commerzbank and Germany is interesting for that reason, because we have actually seen a number of Chinese acquisitions, machinery acquisitions, solar industry as well, in Germany over the last 6 months. And so you've got to think that for the Chinese companies, as they're doing more and more deals in Germany, they're looking over their shoulder and wondering why there's not really a Chinese bank that's able to support them there. So it would be a good fit for Chinese banks. The other point as well is that what are the Chinese banks actually trying to acquire? They want to expand their footprint, but they also want to expand their expertise. European banks, despite all their problems, are obviously the best, some of the best banks in the world, and that's something that Chinese banks would like to get a hold of, their knowledge of different banking products and their expertise in corporate banking. So that'd be very attractive for CCB.
I suppose the big question that skeptics might have is, you know, is this something that Chinese banks, which, as you say, have very little experience on the international stage up to now, would be capable of managing? Could they find a way to own and run a subsidiary operation on the other side of the world when their knowledge of Western banking is relatively limited and there's the language problems and so on?
Absolutely, that'd be a huge concern for them. And they've been very honest in acknowledging that they don't actually have the managerial expertise to run a big, sophisticated Western bank, especially one that has a big base of retail depositors. So what they'd be looking for then is to buy either into the more corporate side of things, which is something that they probably are more confident about being able to handle, or take not necessarily a controlling stake, but a big stake in an existing network, and through that stake just gain the access to the sorts of expertise and knowledge that they don't currently possess.
Well, all we need now is for the rhetoric to translate into action in the months that follow. So I'm sure, Simon, you'll be following that as closely as I am. Thanks very much again for joining us. Time to move on to the UK and news that the former head of corporate banking at HBOS, now part of Lloyds Banking Group, has found himself at the wrong end of regulatory action. Brooke, you were looking at the action that the FSA took last week.
Yes, that would be Peter Cummings, who ran corporate lending. This is not at all surprising. When the FSA put out their report on HBOS and said, but for the fact that it was already owned by the taxpayers, they would have fined it for serious misconduct, what they cited were the actions of the corporate lending department that Mr. Cummings ran.
Now, Peter Cummings kind of has become a bit of a famous figure in financial journalism over the past few years because he became associated with a lot of the big deals, big corporate lending deals that HBOS did in the boom years. Charlene, what did he become most well known for?
Well, I think in his early years, actually before he became head of corporate lending, but he was very much in that division, he was quite well known for schmoozing some of the sort of wealthiest entrepreneurs. So Sir Philip Green was a big associate of his and someone that he was renowned for helping back in the early 2000s. He actually backed Sir Philip's takeover of Arcadia, taking a big stake for HBOS and lending a large loan. And that was a successful deal. He also had relationships with Sir Tom Hunter, a number of other big entrepreneurs.
I've just had lunch, incidentally, with someone who's an associate of Philip Green, who said to me, Philip had boasted to him at a drink one evening, just in the midst of trying to take over Marks and Spencer, that all he had to do was call up Mr. Cummings and ask him for $700 million to fund his acquisition, and it would be there the next morning on his desk. He certainly had a reputation for
Yeah, and that kind of sums up how he operated, which was, you know, he was there, he was almost given free rein in the company, you know, he forged these relationships personally with people. And if he stepped in and said, you know, even if this lending breaches our traditional barriers, you know, if he said, yes, it's okay, then the staff, you know, hurriedly sort of set out to make that happen.
He was
very powerful.
He was driving growth at the group, really, at
Absolutely.
A time when HBOS more broadly was maybe struggling in certain of its areas.
Yeah, I mean, as the mortgage lending became harder, you know, they ramped up the targets for the corporate side of the business. Sort of 2006, 2007 saw enormous growth in that side of the business. I think, Brooke, didn't it nearly double during those years?
It rose by 50%.
Okay.
And what's interesting about it is the FSA faulted him not for necessarily having a stupid growth plan, which I think in retrospect he probably did, but for doing it at a time when he knew that the risk controls were troubled and were not up to FSA standards, and he was supposed to be fixing the risk controls. So the FSA basically said, you knew you didn't have risk controls and you chose to go for an aggressive strategy anyway, and that's not okay. And his personal role was also very important to getting him in the regulator sights, because always when a division goes bad, the question is whose fault is it? And because he was so personally associated with some of the riskiest decisions, I think the regulator felt quite comfortable going after him.
And so the regulator ultimately decided to ban him for life from a financial services job, is that right? Plus the £500,000 fine.
Exactly. And at the same time, they said they had closed their investigation in regards to HBOS. So by all accounts, that means his superiors, the ones who helped set those aggressive targets, will not face personal action.
And it was that point particularly that Peter Cummings came out against incredibly strongly.
Yeah, coming back to what I was saying at the beginning, he certainly felt aggrieved that he was the only one, the singled out.
Absolutely. I mean, his language is extraordinary. He said, you know, it was sinister. He said it was grotesque. He's used incredibly strong language to have a go at the FSA. He felt it was very unfair that he was singled out in the way he was. And actually, it's very rare. I mean, we have had so few of these personal cases in the financial crisis. If you think who, you know, you look at anyone at RBS, no one was held personally responsible.
Northern Rock, there were a couple, but that was slightly more different.
They were held responsible not for their strategy decisions or their overall lending policies. They were held responsible for a specific reporting failure that clearly violated the rules. I mean, they basically misreported their arrearages, and even the FSA admits the thing they misreported is not why Northern Rock went down.
Well, I suspect Mr. Cummings may have to satisfy himself with whinging to us, because it doesn't, as you say, Brooke, it doesn't feel like the FSA is going to take any further action against the other banks. We should move on to our final topic, which is another kind of legal issue around UBS, the Swiss bank, which had a trader famously a year or so ago, Kweku Adeboli, who allegedly cost the bank a couple of billion euros. This trial, which has been a long time coming, has finally started, Brooke. It's been a fairly noisy affair as well. I mean, it's not started quietly.
Absolutely not. The prosecution came out hard with, they have an email that Mr. Adeboli wrote right after his trading positions were questioned, right as his scheme fell apart, in which he apologized and said he was deeply sorry for having left the mess, and basically said the fault is mine and mine alone.
This is a message to his boss, which...
No, it's a message to his boss and also to the compliance guy who was asking who's on the other side of these trades.
And the suggestion from this is that he knew he was in the wrong, and more importantly, his argument that his superiors knew exactly what he was doing is kind of nullified by the fact that he's apologizing to them for having done it for the first time very late in the day.
Exactly. He doesn't say, I'm sorry I got caught. He says, I'm sorry I did this, which I think is probably not great news for him. It may be more complicated, obviously. We have not heard the defense side.
Yeah. And the trial's due to last for another, seven or eight weeks?
Probably. Those are always a little bit hard to determine, because it sometimes depends whether the defendant takes the stand, because if they do take the stand, that takes forever, and there's lots of interesting testimony. And if they don't, the trial ends very abruptly.
Yeah. Well, we'll obviously be watching that trial as it progresses over the next couple of months, but just wanted to record, really, that it's begun. Sadly, we've run out of time for today. That was all from Banking Weekly for this week. Thanks very much to Brooke and Charlene in the studio, and to Simon Rabinovich in Beijing. You can catch up with all of the latest banking news online at ft.com/banking. Banking Weekly was produced by Emily Cadman. Until next week, goodbye.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about AI and the business travel sector. I speak to Tim LaBelle, head of product for SAP Concur Spend Solutions.
We'll have so much data that our travel will be safer.
Shelley Fletcher-Bryant, VP of Advito.
AI can certainly contribute to more eco-friendly travel practices.
And author and public speaker, Theo Lau.
AI can help us predict when it will be a peak travel, more delays, cancelled flights.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.